Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Dr. Michael Quinn has been one of the most prominent historians since the 1980s of Mormon history. In our next conversation, I'll ask him if he had any dealings with Mark Hoffman. It turns out that Michael may have inadvertently given Mark some ideas for forgeries. I'll also ask him if he was scared about getting blown up. Check out our conversation. I also want to remind you that if you're interested, we've got Shannon Flynn, Kurt Bench, George Throckmorton, and Sandra Tanner. They all tell their experiences with Mark Hoffman. So those are pretty interesting things. Please subscribe for $10 a month, and I will give you a copy of those by a PDF as soon as it's recorded. So now back to our conversation. All right. So one of the questions that I have, actually I have 1,000, I may have to book you again for another interview, is I've been talking with a few people about Mark Hoffman. So I don't know if you probably haven't followed some of my recent interviews. Shannon Flynn, George Throckmorton, who was the man who discovered how Mark was doing his forgeries. Were you involved with Mark Hoffman at all?
I met Mark Hoffman typically at meetings where we would cross one another in the hallway. There were some times when he was on a panel. I don't think he ever gave a full presentation of his own, but he was on a panel discussion, usually talking about some marvelous find of his in church history. And I've attended one or two of those that I remember. But usually at the Mormon History Association or at Sunstone Symposium, we would kind of pass one another in the hall, say, hi, how are you? And he would go off to whatever session he was interested in, and I would go off to whatever I was. And not often were they the same. The only other times that I met with him was when I was at the church archives doing research. Typically, I avoided taking lunch. I would be there from the time the door opened until the time they threw me out. And I would never take a break for lunch, or rarely take a break for lunch. But I would be in there typing my notes on whatever document I was examining. And he would come in, sometimes alone, sometimes with someone else who was associated with him in one way or the other, and would come over and interrupt me. And I'm barely civil to people who interrupt me when they do research or when I'm doing research. And so I would, yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, let me get back to what I'm doing. And so those were the kinds of conversations I would have with him. There was one time when he brought in the typed text of a document that he said he'd found in some attic, and happened at that time to be the a document about the blessing of Joseph Smith III. And he said, well, what do you think of this? And it was like, wow, I'm interested in this. And I asked him if I could take notes. No. Can I type my own copy of this? No. Even though what he showed me was a typescript. And I never did see any of the documents that he was producing in real form. I only saw photographic productions of them, usually as published in the Deseret News or the Salt Lake Tribune or wherever, or sometimes in an article that was published in BYU Studies or whatever about them. And so that was the extent of our association. The only other thing that I did is I recommended, because I'd given up trying after years of trying to contact descendants of early Mormons who I knew had diaries. And there were two in particular that I recommended to him to follow up on what I knew. And one was William E. McClellan, whose diaries I had found described in a letter at the New York Public Library. And I had tried to follow through his obituary all the surnames of his descendants, not just McClellan, but daughters who had married, mentioned in his obituary, and then a man named Sylvester Smith, who died also in the Midwest. McClellan died in Missouri, and the It was a distant relative, really more of a shirt-tail relative of the Smith family, not a direct relative of theirs. Sylvester Smith died in Nebraska. And so his obituary said that he had kept the diary since he was 12 years old. And I thought, wow, this is something I want to, and it listed all, and he died in about 1885 or so, 1882. And the obituary listed all of his descendants who were living by name. And so I followed not only the descendants named Smith, which was going to be very difficult, but I also followed the children, his daughters, who had married with other surnames. And I went then through telephone books, and I would get every telephone book in the Midwest for both these people, McClellan and the in-laws of Sylvester Smith. And I'd given up. I'd written hundreds of letters to these people over a period of years, never gotten back an answer from any of them. And I'd really just written it off as a lost cause. And so I made recommendations that for the McClellan descendants and for the Sylvester Smith descendants, I gave what I had in terms of the evidence of their keeping diaries during their lives to Mark. And I said, well, you know, this is what you do. You contact descendants and you've been very successful, I thought. And so, you know, here's what I know about the evidence of their keeping journals. And he said he would, you know, follow up on that and let me know. And then in the early 1880s, I was hearing that he had found contacts in the McClellan family about McClellan's papers. And so I was really upset that he hadn't let me know that he had made this contact. So I wrote him a letter and I said, you know, I gave this information to you years ago and you promised to keep me in the loop if you were successful. And I've heard through some of your friends who are mutual friends of mine that you've made the contact with the McClellan family and have his archives, so to speak. And I said, you know, I expect that you should allow me to at least see these and take notes on what I think is interesting. Well, I never heard back from him. And then one day in 1985, in early October, after the Sunstone Symposium, I was walking into the BYU library and he happened to be walking out. And I said, you know, did you get my letter? Yes. And I said, well, I think you owe me the opportunity to examine. And he said, well, I'm bound by agreements I've made with the descendants. And he said, I'll have to check with them. And it was very obvious he did not want to talk with me about this, and that he was uncomfortable, and he kept looking at his watch as I was talking to him. And so that was the extent of the last interaction I had with him. And then a few days, weeks later, boom. Boom, boom. And he killed these people in premeditated murders. And this was, you know, everything fell apart from that time forward, including his forgeries, his life of forgeries that he'd started when he was quite a young man. But that's the extent of my, you know, you've got it. Everything that I knew about him and through personal contact, that was the extent of it.
So were you pretty surprised that he was actually the bomber? You thought he was a
victim? I just thought this was not the Mark Hoffman I knew, who was just very shy, very retiring person. I mean, I talked about him being uncomfortable and talking and looking at his watch, but the other times he barely got eye contact. I thought he was one of the shyest people I had met in Mormon History Association. And typically, I learned more about what he was doing from friends of his, like Brent Metcalf, who, you know, frequently socialized with him. I never socialized with Mark Hoffman, and I don't think he never invited me to, even though I was interested in things he was interested in, and I passed on some of the leads that I had for getting stuff that I thought was in attics somewhere in the Midwest. And it turned out they were. But these people who acknowledged at one point receiving letters from me, you know, it was like, who's this guy? And he's connected with BYU, and why should we believe him? And And they were contacted eventually by a reporter from the Salt Lake
City. So he probably got some ideas from his forgeries from you.
And he may have from things I published. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because typically I would talk about things that weren't available, that were central. Like I published an article about the Council of 50 Minutes and the Council of 50's history, and I commented about what I thought was in those minutes that I had not seen of the Nauvoo Council of 50. And so I would do this about other documents, like I wrote about the blessings that Joseph Smith III had received from his father. And that obviously was something that Mark Hoffman paid attention to. But in terms of conferring with him and, you know, planning out strategies, the closest I came to it was giving him these two sources about William E. McClellan and about Sylvester Smith, that I thought would lead to, you know, him contacting somebody who had something squirreled away in an attic. And that was about the only consulting I ever did with him.
So you weren't concerned about getting blown up or anything?
Well, I got calls on the day that he was blown up with one that he had in his car. The people at the time thought had been planted in his car. Mm-hmm. I was told to, you know, don't go back to the apartment you're living in, because at that time I was newly divorced and was living in a bachelor apartment. And so I had a friend who worked with the state attorney, U.S. attorney. It was in his office, and this longtime friend of mine called and said, don't go back home, go and stay with us, because no one would think of us, of him and his wife. And so he provided more than a week, I think a week or 2 weeks, of residence for me during this period. And then he told me, when you go back, look under your car for wires, and anytime you get, and for years after this, following his advice, anytime I got a package I wasn't expecting, I would take it to the post office and run it through their X-ray machine to see if there were any machines in it. So yeah, I was paranoid.
Wow, so there was pretty widespread then. There was a lot of people that were scared.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Michael Quinn. In our next conversation, we'll talk about the succession crisis, and Michael will talk about the various leaders that could have taken over after Joseph Smith's death.
It could have been a variety, and the article that I published in 1975, years before Hoffman came out with any of the wonderful documents that he came out in Mormon history about. I said that there were seven legitimate ways of succeeding Joseph Smith that he had made provision for, either within his published revelations or within things that he had done that were well known. And Brigham Young was only one of them. Sidney Rigdon was a surviving counselor, was only one of these methods. And Brigham Young and the 12 apostles was in many ways a distant possibility by revelation.
I hope you enjoyed that short clip from our next interview. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents and subscribe for just $5 a month. If you'd like a transcript of this, please click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you this and all future transcripts. Also, if you'd like a paperback like we've got here, those are available at our website at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents. Please get all updates at our Facebook page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Thanks again for listening. Your support helps create more Mormon history classes and podcasts such as this, and so I really appreciate you listening. Please share with your friends. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.